called to order. It is 1:08, and present for the record are Representatives Guerra, Coghill, Wilson, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. The date is the 25th, and we have got four items on the agenda today. As I said in the last meeting, we're going to go ahead and take up House Bill 321 first by Representative Ramross, since we did not get to it. So as a courtesy to him, we'll take that bill up first and take testimony on it. Then we're going to go to House Bill 318, which is the eminent domain bill. We've got some amendments to discuss, and I'm hoping, being optimistic, that we could try to move it out of the committee today after we do some work on it. Senate Bill 132, Human Rights Commission, is back before us. It was a bill we had last year, just to refresh members' memory. And then House Bill 314, we've been told that we'll take that up at a later point. So you can disregard 314 for now, but not forever.
Yes,
or
you're
else
here.
You'll hear from the sponsor, Representative Coghill. So without further ado, and Representative Grunberg has joined us as well. Thank you, Max. So without further ado, Representative Ramross, tell us about 321.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I brought all these people to testify this bill. Actually, I don't think we're going to have any, I don't think we have any public testimony scheduled today other than presenting this to you. I'd like to share with the committee. I had an excellent conversation with the Rules Chairman yesterday, and he told me that a couple of years ago in Anchorage that they had just a string of alcohol-related fatalities, and I believe that was the genesis for HB4 at that time. And I will share with you, Madam Chair, that the same unfortunate circumstance has befallen the community of Fairbanks this summer, and that we have had a string of alcohol-related fatalities. And became quite a significant issue in our community. And after attending, I'd say 10 or 15 meetings this summer, many of which were sponsored by Mothers Against a Drunk Driver. One of them was sponsored by our presiding officer of our borough assembly, Luke Hopkins, who's here in your judiciary room today. We met and we've considered therapeutic courts, and we have considered other issues to try to remedy this severe problem, which are not just people driving while intoxicated, which is its own problem, but what is called high-risk operation of a motor vehicle. And the traffic fatalities that are related to people that can't distinguish between three drinks or four drinks, which is, you know, let's say for a person my size would be the legal limit to, you know, take me to from 0.08 to 0.082, might be somewhere in between my third and fourth drink, depending on how quickly I consumed it. The trouble that I have is those folks that can't distinguish between a moving vehicle and a stationary vehicle, between a stop sign and no stop sign, a red light and a green light, and those people are the ones that are drinking to such an extent that they not only break the law but become an enormous hazard to those of us in the community. And so as we were looking for problems and a way to solve those problems this summer, we saw that 31 states have adopted a policy toward high-risk operation of a motor vehicle. And government has the power of providing a deterrent to the community to discourage behavior. And then government also has the power to punish people once people have violated our laws. And there are, because of my private sector job, I operate liquor licenses, so I know a great deal. I think about the psychology of people that choose to consume alcohol and then operate a motor vehicle. whether they're at .02, .04, .06, and those people that, you know, drink to excess. And, you know, we have implemented server training programs. We have laws against bartenders, servers, owners of establishments that have licenses from over-serving. And nevertheless, you know, we see thousands of DUIs each year. But as we look at, if you, and I did not provide one, but if you look at a graph of where the fatalities come from, it is disproportionately on those that have consumed an enormous amount of alcohol. And so this bill aims to address that problem. And the three deterrents that government has at its disposal are to tell you, one, that if you hurt somebody, if you maim them, or if you kill them, you will be subject to a certain set of criminal penalties, manslaughter, for instance, or civil suits. The second one is government's ability to levy a fine measured in dollars against you. If we find you drunk driving, you'll get fined $1,500. You'll pay for your own incarceration. You'll get SR-22 insurance. And the third deterrent that government has to offer is jail time. And I would, what this bill aims to do, Madam Chair, is as an operator of a bar, when you talk to people that are consuming alcohol, because I'd like to really get at the root of the problem as I have witnessed it as a citizen, as a legislator, and as an operator of liquor licenses. Because when somebody leaves a drinking establishment, it is never their intent to do harm to another individual. Therefore, it is a very ineffective deterrent to tell them, what if you go hurt somebody? Because it's not something that any of us in this room would consciously think, man, I drank so much I could kill somebody. And the second one is the penalties, the, you know, $1,500, $3,000, pick any amount. Until you get that bill in the mail from the government agency that says you owe the state of Alaska or the court system $2,700 or $1,500 for your fines for incarceration, until Allstate or State Farm or Geico, whoever, says, hey, SR-22, welcome to, you know, triple your insurance premiums. The most successful deterrent that I have seen, Madam Chair, are people who are like, I cannot drive my vehicle because I'm going to go to jail. I'm afraid of going to jail. I'm afraid that there's a cop right outside that's gonna catch me, and they're going to breathalyze me, and then they're going to put me in jail. And I have seen myself that is the most effective deterrent that government has, because ideally what government wants to do is to say, don't participate in this behavior. And I have my own feelings about .08, but I accept that as the law of our state, and I respect that, and I honor that, and I'm very careful in my own behavior and in the way that we serve people, you know, in my establishments. But when somebody exceeds the .08, sometimes that can happen because they are trying to be responsible. They say, you know, I think I've been sitting here for 2 hours, and I think that my body weight, I think I can have three drinks. And maybe they, you know, have a sip of a fourth drink, Representative Garrett, just like you took a sip of that coffee, and that's what pushes them over when they get breathalyzed, as they leave that establishment for, you know, failure to yield, failure to use a blinker, to have, you know, maybe not wear their seatbelt. Yes, ma'am, that's correct. And that takes them over the legal limit, and they're subject to all the fines and penalties, and I'm not suggesting in any way that we should lessen that. But, Madam Chair, once somebody has consumed enough alcohol that they would be breathalyzed at a .16 or greater, I believe that kind of behavior is so counterproductive to safety, to being a good citizen. I think you'd be a good citizen and be right at that .08 limit, and you're trying to enjoy the rights and privileges that accrue to us as law-abiding citizens, but that you can make a mistake and then you're subject to those penalties. But at .16, I think that the behavior is simply unacceptable. So what we're proposing is double the blood alcohol content, double the jail time. And the reason is because so much of the state of Alaska's program against drunk driving revolves around public service announcements that say, this is bad behavior, don't do it. You know, don't drink and drive. If you, I can't remember the slogan that's out there right now, you know, but you're going to jail. You know, if, you know, leave the keys. I mean, there have been a number of these programs, and 31 states have adopted this. I think it will lead to fewer fatalities, to better behavior of people who choose to put away their car keys. It's been in, I've enjoyed the endorsement of both Mothers Against Drunk Drivers and CHAR on this. The wholesale distributors have also endorsed this. It's good common sense. I will tell you that Representative Rokeberg, who's done a lot of work on this issue, is concerned about the fiscal note that it will generate. We won't know what that fiscal note is, I believe, until it moves through this committee. But we need to do some common sense things. I'm not a prohibitionist. I'm not a teetotaler, if that's the right, if I'm saying that correctly. I believe that people have the right to consume alcohol. They need to do it responsibly. If you exceed 0.08, then you are subject to the crimes and penalties that come with that. But once you are at 0.16, we have to find a way to get people to put their car keys back in their pocket, to take a cab, to be more responsible, and we have to do what we can to reduce the amount of fatalities that are on the road today. You would face double minimum sentences. So if you were at 0.16, instead of 3 days in jail, it'd be a mandatory 6 days in jail. Second offense, if you exceeded the BAC level by double, instead of 10 days in jail, it would be 20 days in jail, and so on. We are exploring, we believe that the Transportation Equity Act for the 21st Century, amended Section 410, alcohol-impaired countermeasure incentive grant may be available to the state. So much like the argument for the primary seatbelt law, there may be some funds available for us to have tougher DUI laws. I'm trying to approach this with some common sense. I know that people are afraid of going to jail. And regular people are, and people that consume alcohol. And if we make it a little bit tougher on them, I think we may have safer roads.
Thank you, Representative Ramos. You mentioned the 31 states that have adopted laws. Is the methodology the same that they are? We in the ballpark after your bill in terms of their sentencing guidelines? How does it compare?
Yes, ma'am. I would say that the difference largely is the 0.15 is seen as more of a national standard. But because I do so much marketing, Madam Chair, I think double the BAC, double the jail time is a much simpler concept for the general public to get. And frankly, we've already failed. Once we arrest you for DWI, we've already failed. The idea is to provide enough of a deterrent to keep people that are really drunk from getting in their cars, because that's when people are getting hurt statistically. But insofar as the penalties, I think that consistently we see that at this high BAC level, you know, all states have a different standard, but the standard becomes much more significant at the high BAC level. And I'd be delighted to provide the committee members with. Do they have a copy of this?
They do.
Okay.
A copy
in there. National Conference of State Legislatures provides the standard in here for all other states, which is...
That'd be great. And then just one other question, then I'll go to other members. So since I've been here, we've passed a number of bills dealing with drunk driving, all of them stiffening the penalties. And I guess what I'm always trying to figure out is, you know, where that line is, because certainly I think everyone in this room agrees that drunk driving is reprehensible and should be punished and should be deterred. And then so where is it appropriate to draw the line? Is there any evidence, or do you have anything that you could provide the committee, that the laws that we've passed over the last 6 years with House Bill 4 and others to strengthen the penalties either aren't working, or we would be better served as a society if we were to strengthen even those laws further? And if you have that, I'd be happy to have that as a part of the record. I guess that's always the struggle is, you know, it always sounds great to get out there and say, let's be tough on drunk drivers. And let's be as, you know, we made a joke, I think, one time in this committee that last year that we ought to just have a bill that says we just take people out and shoot them. I mean, because that's kind of where we're going, that we're really just sort of saying this is
Wasn't
one of the
Wasn't that part of the sentencing bill?
Yeah, right. This is sort of really the worst crime you can commit, and we're just, you know, it's just basically a death sentence, and not to make light of it, but really to say that of all the crimes out there, this one tends to get the most attention. And so it's easy to introduce one, and you're going to get a lot of support and a lot of folks that will have stories that are very emotional to go with it. But then where is there any evidence that shows that moving from where we have
Yes, ma'am.
Been as a state to where you would like to go is going to be worth the cost
Yes, ma'am.
Of the jail time and the prosecution and defense and so on?
Yes, ma'am. I share your point of view, and I'm also concerned about the, you know, taking up valuable time here in this committee. I will tell you that I'm not interested in hearing victims' testimony because, as significant as it is, it just underlines the same point. I will tell you that we have requested the information you're asking about and have not received it at this point from Department of Public Safety or the Department of Corrections. And but I can tell you, Madam Chair, speaking from the point of view as an operator of liquor licenses, jail time, being stopped, being arrested, is the single greatest deterrent for people that are consuming alcohol. It's what makes them not order that next drink. Okay. And Minnesota's high blood alcohol content threshold is relatively high. They put it at 0.20. But strong sanctions have made it effective. The study found that the high BAC law lowered recidivism and refusal rates among high BAC first-time offenders. And it does not include any statistics at this point. I think that this is a good policy for the legislature to pursue. We are gathering additional information on this issue. I'd be delighted to come back in front of the committee at another time, or certainly as we generate a fiscal note and this moves on to the next committee of referral. If the Judiciary Committee is comfortable with that, we certainly will be subject to their scrutiny and their concerns. My own opinion, my gut, Madam Chair, from being in that trade, I have operated a beer and wine license and then a beverage dispensary licenses since, I believe, 1989. So I have 15 or 16 years. So I can tell you I'm an expert witness in human behavior, in the consumption of alcohol and the responsible consumption thereof. And we need to further dissuade people that are already problem drinkers from picking up their car keys and not taking a cab, and that jail time, in my mind, is the most effective deterrent to do that. And what we'll have to measure it against is what the, you know, not only the will of the committee, but also the fiscal note that it generates to determine whether, you know, we're buying more safety or just buying more loss. And I do appreciate the distinction between those two points, which seems to be your concern and well articulated, Madam Chair.
Questions? Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with the Chair's comments that you know, I was just looking through the number of times we've changed the law, once in 1993, once in 1994, 95, 96, 2001, 2002, 2004. I think I double-counted one of those. But it, and each time we do it, we say we have the model DWI law, and then somebody comes in and says, we've got a really weak DWI law, and then this year we have a really model DWI law, and then all of a sudden next year it's a weak one. And I'm wondering whether or not some of this isn't working. The thing I'm struggling with on your bill, Representative Ramros, is you said before that at a breath alcohol of 1.6, then it becomes really outrageous. And I'm sitting here thinking it's really outrageous at 1.5. I think it's really outrageous at 1.4 that somebody would be so irresponsible that they decide to drive knowing they can kill somebody, even at 1.4 or 1.3. And I almost worry that something like this might have a reverse effect where somebody thinks, well, 1.4, that's the, you know, the state said that's sort of bad. 1.6 is really bad. So, I mean, why do we want to make them focus on 1.6? If you think this is going to have an impact on their behavior at 1.6, what is this thought process we think we're going to have with criminals Is it only going to affect those people who would drive at 1-5 but at 1-6 say, oh, now I think I'm doing something wrong? I don't understand.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm with you. And frankly, that's why the local chapter, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, actually opposed this initially, as they shared your precise point of view, which is, how do you draw a distinction between legally drunk and really drunk? And is it counterintuitive, the behavior that it promotes? And it was when the other MAD chapters from across the country came in and said, this is working in our states, please support this, that the local MAD chapter came around in its thinking. And I'm with you. The law is 0.08. The fact is that at 0.06, I'm impaired, but I'm not impaired to the standard that we have set as criminal. But at 0.16, and again, I told you, I selected that number because it's easy for impaired people who have already surrendered their judgment to understand a poster or a public service announcement that says double the blood alcohol content, double the jail time. And I want to make sure that people that are really inebriated think harder about getting into a vehicle. The people that are already concerned at 0.06, 07, 08, 09, that are saying, you know what, I'm going to stay here and have a cup of coffee or a diet soda, or can I sit here for an hour? And we have people that will do that, sit and have a glass of water, and we encourage it. And there are other people that know to take a cab, or they come to an establishment by a cab, or they have a designated driver. And I will tell you that I don't agree with your assessment that it's model and then it's weak. I'm not suggesting that. I think that Alaska has one of the toughest and strongest and best set of DUI laws, but that this will further strengthen it, that it makes our community safer, that there is a segment of our population that already drink to a legal limit or to excess, and that they will think harder about it if we set a bar that says, you know, because right now you know as soon as you've decided that you're going to break the law, there's no other governor, there's no threshold, I mean, there's no other safety net that worsens it. You could be, you know, golly, I think I read in our paper in Fairbanks at 0.28. I don't know how somebody can even be conscious at 0.28, but they got stopped for DWI with that kind of blood alcohol level. And there is no other governor or threshold point to suggest that, because all there is what the language that you hear is, it's only your first DWI. It's not so bad. I mean, that's what you hear. There's no other governor. It's only 3 days. It's okay. I got it. I had a DWI. I'm not saying I did. I haven't. I haven't.
You just said you did.
Yes.
You're on record.
You can't take that back.
Your Honor, I'd like to. But this is the dialogue that you will hear from people. It's, oh, it's only your first one. I did mine. It was 3 days. It was no big deal. And so what I'm suggesting is that we need to put something in place to try and put a governor on these people that just have just a reckless disregard. Once they've decided to blow through that 0.08, I mean, they're gone. But the only deterrent that I've seen that's effective is the jail time. They hate the jail time, and so it's really just from the gut that more jail time will be a greater deterrent.
I agree with some of the sentiment, but what I'm really concerned about is the ad campaign that you are envisioning, where you take out ads and saying, "I want double it," and you're really in trouble, and we're making people focus on 1-6. I want them to focus on 1-4. I want them to focus on 1-2. I don't want to take out an ad campaign saying, "Don't worry about it till you're at 1-6," because we all know from politics that you essentially get one sentence in your ad, and people will then just tune you out in an ad. You get about a sentence, and if your sentence is going to be 1-6, then I think that makes people more willing to drive drunk at 1-4. That's the first part. The other part you mentioned is really intriguing, and maybe that's the direction we should go. I also think that in a lot of cases, the 3-day jail time for your first DWI is viewed as just an inconvenience by people with a real problem. So, and I wonder whether we should have a mandatory higher first-time sentence, and then you put it on the defendant to prove with substantial evidence that they're really not a problem, and then they get 3 days, you know. But it would be on the defendant's, it would be their burden to show that they're really not somebody the court should worry about ever seeing again. And that'll probably be most people. But I think you do have a point on, at least for some people, the shorter jail time for the first DWI. And the truth is, a court sometimes imposes 5-10 days for the first one. But I guess I don't know how often that is.
Through the chair, Representative Gehr, I couldn't disagree with you more on both points. And it's actually 45 days with 42 days suspended is usually the standard.
3 days.
These are, through the chair, these are amongst the toughest DUI laws in the country. And what I'm trying to do is to take the people that are that don't care. I mean, we went through a series of meetings with Director Bannock from Division of Motor Vehicles, and he talked about the lunacy of suspended licenses, and that you get your first DWI, your license is suspended for 30 days. You get your second one, it's suspended for a year. You get your third one, it's for 5 years, and that what we end up with are repeat offenders, habitual DUI offenders that end up with their license suspended for 125 years. For several lifetimes, and they've up to their fifth DWI, and so far as the standard of 0.08, I support that standard, and we enforce that standard, and we do not overserve. We have all TAMS trained servers in our establishment, techniques of alcohol management, and we enforce, you know, the education that comes by way of that. But the fact is that people do choose to drink beyond that limit, and at 0.08, people have broken the law, but it wrecks a lot of lives. A lot of people they've lost their jobs, they've lost their homes, they've lost their financial footing in this world because of SR-22. And these are not necessarily habitual drinkers. These are people who have gone to wedding receptions or openings for the museum and have consumed a sip too much of alcohol that has taken them over the 0.08 standard, and I support the fact that they should be held accountable to that criminal standard. But we have people out there that are habitual drinkers that are drinking way in excess of the 0.08 standard, and that what will dissuade them, what will be an acceptable deterrent for them, is more jail time, because that is the most readily visible deterrent for people who have already surrendered their rational thought process and their reasoning, which is what DPS will tell you is what happens, is a sober person wouldn't drive drunk, but once they're drunk, they've already lost their rational sense, and that is what makes them pick up their car keys. And so, you know, it's a slippery slope, and I appreciate where you're coming from, but I'm trying to do something that has some common sense behind it, and yet to your standard, it makes a regular person like you or like myself have to hold their nose a little bit to vote yes, and I'm encouraging you to do that, sir.
Representative Wilson, and then Gruenberg.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Representative Ramirez. I'm pleased, actually, with this bill, and especially with the double fines. You know, Alaska is the state that has the honor of being number one in alcohol abuse of all the states in the United States. You know, and so, you know, we have to do something about that, because not only as a safety issue for everybody else, that these few people are causing terrible, terrible devastation to families and to property and whatnot, but it's not only a safety issue, but it's a financial issue, because of alcohol, we see increased suicides, and by the way, we're number one in that, increased domestic violence, I think we're number one in that, and you know, So why not get some of the money back? And because it's costing the state unbelievable amounts of money. And I heard in another committee this morning a huge amount. And I hate to even say it, because it was like in the millions that it costs the state of Alaska just because of alcohol abuse. So I think that this is just something that is one of the consequences of the problem, and we need to deal with it.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have basically four questions, if I may just. First, on your sponsor statement here, where you're in the last paragraph, where you're talking about the alcohol server education, the term, this legislation allows professional servers to renew their alcohol server education cards. You're not talking about House Bill 321. You're talking about the other legislation, right?
Yes, yes, sir.
I would suggest that you might want to clarify that, because I spent about 5 minutes looking at this bill, and
yes,
I didn't see anything about that in here. Number two.
That's an oversight. Thank
number
you.
Two, I want to look at the fiscal notes for a moment. I've been long concerned about accuracy of fiscal notes, and I'd like to focus for just a moment. I'm using you because you're handy. You're in the hot seat. You're an opportunity, target of opportunity. Nothing personal. I love you both. But I want to, to really look at the difference between public safety and law. Law is much more honest, and they say in the last paragraph, law estimates that at least half the drunk driving cases will involve basically this bill, and how just on a policy basis, the person who prepared public safety, and I don't know if they're in here, I like them too, but how they can say it's zero, because for now, this cost would be absorbed by utilizing existing resources of the department. Final sentence in that fiscal note. That's just wrong. That's not accurate, and I hope you talk to them and we can get that corrected. And I realize I'm kind of, this isn't much of a question, but the other two are a little bit, well, I'm moving into the question area. Less soliloquy, more dialogue, but I got one first. The difference between version F and version G, and I don't know if we've had a motion to adopt the CS yet, but it looks to me from at least your sectional analyses, and you provided one for F and one for G here, it looks to me like the main difference is that you're raising the maximum that can be imposed for the cost of imprisonment from $2,000 to $4,000, and that appears in the bill, in the CS, page 4, lines 5, page 6, line 9. Am I correct that that's the main real difference between the two versions? And maybe I'm asking Jane this more than you.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, yes.
Okay. And at some point, if you want a motion to adopt the CS.
I'd love one right now.
Moved. So moved.
Is there an objection to adopting version F for purposes of discussion?
And I would say that appears, I'm sorry, I guess we've adopted it. That would appear that that change seems entirely reasonable because it's expensive to house these folks.
Objection? Okay, hearing none, we have version F before us for discussion purposes.
Now,
Representative Gruenberg.
Okay, I do really.
I'm sorry.
Representative Guerra.
I don't have version F. I've got G. But
version F is the CS. And if you want to reserve your objection to looking at it, I don't care. But may I continue, Madam
yes,
Chair, while
please.
He's doing that? Okay. The one thing that I am concerned about, and I've preached this to this choir before, and I'll do it again, that when I was co-chair of this committee with a guy named Peter Gall, he always used to say, look at the repealers. So we look at the repealers. And I want to look at the repealer in this, and it's the final line in the bill. And by the way, I think this is a good bill. I'm past that point. Where you're repealing a statute, and I've had that statute given out. It's page 589 from Title 28. It's AS 28.35.032. And it deals with, basically, it's the current law is if you're not released on time, strictly on time, within 12 hours, you can't sue the state. That I'm not a great fan of tort reform, but I think that's a reasonable provision. Surely you didn't mean to repeal that in this bill. I think there must be a misprint, and we don't have to take that up. But before this bill moves out, I'm looking at you mainly, Jane.
Yes.
I don't think that's what you intended to do, was it?
No, only under this, not the whole.
Well, I think we should cure that problem. There's obviously something wrong there, Madam Chair. And I would like to not see the bill move till we cure that problem, because I just don't see us wanting to repeal that. Thank you. That's all I have to say.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I assure you that Jane will be disciplined appropriately later.
And
I have a question about that.
And also through the chair, Representative Wilson, although we adjusted the fees for incarceration, we did not change the fines, and I will tell you that the rationale behind that was that fines are regressive. and that a more affluent person can afford to pay greater fines, but affluent or from a lower socioeconomic group, jail time is just as inconvenient for the wealthy as it is for people of lesser means. And that was our intent with this, was to inconvenience people by additional jail time, by the shame, the embarrassment, and the discomfort of additional jail time. And while I'm still on the record on this, I would like to say that Jane has been just invaluable in helping to craft this, and we appreciate you pointing these things out to us, Representative Gruenberg, to help toughen it.
We've recognized Jane previously. She's a great star.
Terrific. Yes, sir.
If, Jane, I've got one person to testify, Ronald Taylor from the Department of Health and Social Services, and while I'm taking his testimony, if you want to try to resolve the repealer issue, you likely have the votes to move the bill out today. And so you might want to put some time in that. Okay, so, and Representative Anderson joined us some time ago for the record, and so let's go to Mr. Taylor, please, who's online.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Taylor. I am the Alcohol Safety Action Program Manager with the Department of Health and Social Services. I am actually very pleased to see that this bill has come forward, and I want to address a couple of questions here in a few minutes that was raised earlier by Madam Chair and one of the other representatives. If we go back, Representative Ramirez, I just want to just thank you for putting forward this bill, giving us an opportunity to take a look at the high-risk driver. This has been something that our department has long viewed as an issue, that these offenders pose a greater public safety risk, and they eat up an enormous amount of our resources to deal with them because they are at a higher level and have actually built up a higher tolerance to alcohol. So let me address the couple of questions that was raised earlier. Madam Chair, I think you actually said that you were concerned whether or not we were just passing laws to pass laws, and whether or not any of the previous DUI bills that have been reviewed have actually had a deterrent effect.
Yes.
Okay, I'm looking at some statistics from DMV that I'd be more than happy to share with you. That just looking at calendar year 2004 to calendar year 2005. In calendar year 2004, we had 5107 DUIs in the state. And in calendar year 2005, that number dropped to 4312. This is actually having a very positive effect. The other issue that I want to address is one that I believe that Representative Guerra raised, in terms of we've been going over and over and over and making changes to DUI laws, but I think what is missed here is that we've been doing this in stages. We certainly have not taken a comprehensive look at all of the things that needed to be changed in DUI laws. We've literally been moving to this point, and Alaska is certainly one of the top states in terms of uniformity dealing with DUI laws. We don't have the horrors that I hear from other states in terms of their DUI enforcement, where you can go across the county line or across the city line and be treated as a new first offender. Here, when you get a DUI in Dillingham, that DUI we use for sentencing purposes and for our treatment purposes, the same as if you got the DUI in Anchorage. It doesn't matter to us where that actually occurred at. I am glad that we are addressing this. I also have the statistics to show that over 60% of our DUI offenders actually have BACs over the 0.15 level or have refused. So when we're talking about whether or not this is really worth our effort to deal with, I'm telling you, this is one of the areas that we have been very remiss in not dealing with. It's important that these offenders actually are held accountable, and that we actually have them giving back to what they're actually putting into our system. They're causing us enormous costs in terms of public safety, criminal justice, and health and social services. And I know that there are some concerns of the fiscal notes. That was one of the recommendations that we actually put into our bill analysis is that you actually increase everything. You need to send a very clear message that this person, as a high-risk driver, is something that we do want to deter. We don't want that person to become a high-risk driver. Nationally, the BAC level is 0.15, and that's something that we would recommend, that the language be changed to literally put us in line with the NHTSA's definition of what a high-risk driver is. The second thing is that we proportionally increase the jail time, increase the fines, and even the DMV reinstatement fees. The money that you can gain from the reinstatement fees and from the fines could actually go back to offset some of the fiscal notes that may come up in terms of this bill. And the other thing is that we need to clearly articulate who qualifies as a high-risk driver. I'll give you an example. If I was a third-time DUI offender and I had a BAC above 0.15, does that mean now that I get the aggravated penalties, or does that mean that I needed to have prior high-risk BACs in my previous two DUIs? Those are things that I think that we really need to clearly articulate so that it will avoid legal challenges in the future. And then the last thing that I would like to just suggest, or at least our department would like to recommend, that a proportion of these funds actually come back to support the ASAP program, the prevention and treatment sections of the division. This has been the one thing that legislatively we've heard, that the users need to be accountable for paying for the services, and that you actually wanted more money from user fees to go back into supporting programs like the ASAP program and treatment and prevention, and this would be an excellent opportunity to accomplish that. We think that the benefits of passing this bill will allow us to be in compliance with the NHTSA's programmatic criteria, which is, for example, passing a high-risk bill for 0.15. We're also addressing the primary seatbelt legislation, and one of the things that if you use a portion of these fines to go into prevention programs or traffic safety programs, it will actually be three of the measures that we would use to qualify us for highway safety traffic incentive grants. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, just briefly, and then there are other questions from the committee. Thank you very much for your testimony. On that point of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration grants, will we qualify if we pass this bill today with 0.16 as opposed to 0.15?
Madam Chair, I'm actually not sure. I know that the programmatic criteria actually says a law that imposes stronger sanctions or additional penalties for high-risk drivers whose BAC is 0.15% or more.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, sir. You very quickly came up with four or five proposed amendments, and I didn't copy them all down. Do you have amendments prepared or your testimony in writing or anything so that we can really see what you're talking about? You've given us some thoughts, but they're very nascent at this point. And if we're going to seriously consider what you're saying, we need to really consider each of your things. And like the chair's question, we need to know the answer to that. And if you really want us to make changes, we need to have something really concrete here, sir. Do you have anything for us?
I can provide that for you, sir.
Okay. And proposed amendments or a marked-up copy of the bill or something. And when you're talking about some legal questions, and I don't know if it was the one that Chair McGuire was talking about or something else, if you have a legal opinion to back up what you're saying, something that it's hard for me as a lawyer to really know what's what unless we really see something about that.
Why don't, Mr. Taylor, would you be willing to get in writing those thoughts to Representative Ramros's staff? And why don't, I think what we ought to do is we'll continue to take any final questions we have or any final testimony, And then I'll go ahead and set this aside until Friday, and we can bring it up at the top of the hour. And at that point in time, Jane, you can synthesize the information from Mr. Taylor. The committee will be very interested to know whether it makes a difference in these grants, because the difference between 1.1, 0.15, and 0.16 isn't much. I understand the marketing idea, but I mean, I think you can still kind of get at it. And if it's going to be a loss in federal grants, then we ought to know that. And then further is the repealer information. So if you could be prepared for that for Friday, that would be great.
Could we have that from Mr. Taylor to the committee, too,
yeah,
in advance?
And Mr. Taylor, do you want our fax number here?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so it's 465-6592.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Groom?
May I make a request to Representative Ramos?
Chair, we take requests.
Appreciate it. Good restaurateur idea. if you can see what you can do on those fiscal notes, too, I'd like to really have this done right.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we're anxious to see fiscal notes on this also to determine whether it's the cost is worth the public good. We're as curious as you are, because I leaned over and said, well, we don't have fiscal note, and Representative Grunberg's fiscal notes say zero also or indeterminate. And very quickly, Madam Chair, because we're aware of the time, the repealer, Representative Grunberg, only applies refusals to submit to a chemical test, and as far as we know, we will check this again, but it appears that the federal money is available for states that have a BAC level that's between 0.15 and 0.20, so we think we're still inside that sweet spot, but we will verify that.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you. I would like to know, either now or on Friday, why do you want to repeal that? Seems like a good statute to me.
Through the chair, we'll look into it.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, further questions for the committee for Representative Ramos or Mr. Taylor? Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, you have me intrigued but not yet convinced on the statistical point that you made. Certainly if there's been a long-term trend that shows fewer people are driving drunk, that's great, and we should figure out what's causing it. Most of the laws that we passed were in the mid-90s. You gave me a statistic that said between 2003 and 2004 there was a 20% reduction in DWI arrests. Do you have statistics for other years so we can see whether that's a real long-term trend or whether that was a blip?
I could certainly go back and grab that, sir.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill number 321? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed. We'll bring House Bill number 321 up this Friday at the top of the hour. Okay, thank you, Representative Ramos. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Okay, that brings us to House Bill number 318, second hearing, eminent domain. And we're looking for Craig.
Okay. By the way, I would have liked to put on the record that Craig came into my office. We talked a lot. I found him extremely helpful, and I'd like to thank you for making him available.
That's great.
Thank you. You want to say that again?
That again.
Thank you, sir.
Fabulous. That's fabulous. Okay, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. For the record, Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Craig Johnson, and I am staff to Representative Lisa McGuire. I think we covered a lot of what the premise of it is, but I do want to state the two policies that we're really addressing here. And the first is whether or not taking a person's private property for economic development is justified or not. And the second would be whether it is appropriate to take a person's personal property for recreational. And when I say personal property, I want to clarify, that's a home. That's where they live for recreational purposes. So with that, I think that we do have a CS before us. And if you want me to address the changes in the CS.
I would like you to, please.
There's a lot of similarities. They are very similar bills. I also would like to let you know that I have Don Bullock, Ted Popley, and Peter Putzier here again to answer any of the legal questions that are way over my head in some cases. to address the changes, in Section 1, we pretty much added C, which gave us a fairly clear definition of economic development and public use. Those were some of the questions and concerns in the last meeting. Section 2 remained essentially the same. Section 3, we removed the right of the commissioners to make an approval. That is gone. We also removed on page 4, line 4, we placed that language with common carriers. There were some concerns expressed about the definition there, so we just took out the use of for hire, and we put common carriers in, which is clearly defined by law. And then we added 7, which is also a policy call, which gives the legislature the ability to approve eminent domain. In those cases that we haven't been able to foresee, it somewhat replaces the commissioners, but it puts it back on the body, this body, to approve legislation. If someone comes up with a specific need that we haven't covered or we haven't thought of, or in the future something comes up, this allows the legislature to say, yes, it's okay in this particular instance or in this set of circumstances to do that. So there is a way in this legislation to allow a fix if we haven't covered everything. We've worked very hard, and I would certainly hate to be paying attorneys by the hour who have worked on this. There have been a lot of eyes on it, but that's an out that gives us that opportunity. And the rest of it is pretty much just language consistency. It's a little tighter now, reads a little better. So the rest of it is pretty much just language. We also defined economic development and personal residence in Section 3, where we hadn't before. So those are the primary changes in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And just to clarify on the Section 7, obviously one legislature cannot bind another, and so there's legislative power at any point in time to simply repeal what we have done here should we pass this law, to amend it or whatever on the part of the legislature, should there be a legislator that decides to. But I think what we wanted to do is also allow for the ability of the governor to come up with an idea that we may not have thought of and propose that to us, to have an official request made to the legislature as a stopgap. And that's something we can discuss here today. I'm not married to the idea one way or the other, but the idea of the commissioners I didn't like, and the point behind it was to try to think of a way to address something that we may not have thought of here and now, but that is certainly open for discussion. I would appreciate a motion just to adopt it for discussion purposes. Representative Wilson.
I so move, and then I have a question.
Okay. So is there an objection to adopting version L, the CS, for discussion purposes? Okay. Hearing none, we have the CS before us. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A question for number 7. I'm trying to think, well, what would be an example? Would this be an example, like we wanted the pipeline to go through a certain area, but everybody okayed it to but one, and so, I mean, is that what you're talking about?
Oh, that's a good question. Craig, did you come up with any specifics?
Madam Chair, that's, first of all, the pipeline's exempted, and so that's not the issue. We'd be talking more in the lines of an organized borough saying, and we'll use the bike trail because it seems to be popular, that everyone, 99% of the people said, this is what we need to do. This is where it needs to go. We have to take to make it go where it needs to go, that everyone seems to support. There's this one piece of property that we need to exercise eminent domain over. The legislature would have the ability to vote that up or down. But it's not a definite no. It's not someone can't hold up an immensely popular project for either financial gain or whatever. So it would be a way to allow the legislature to come in and say, yes, this is an appropriate use. This is an overwhelming good of the community. So it'd be more in that type of instance. It wouldn't be, any of the typical development projects we have wouldn't fall into this anyway, because they're exempted. So we're talking about that rare instance that, quite honestly, we haven't thought of, and that's part of the reason it's in there. If we could think of everything, we wouldn't need this out. And as the chairman said, it can be done. Any legislature could do that at any time, but I think there's a certain comfort zone built into this for departments and other people involved if they know that there is, you know, this what we passed today is not the final version. I think Representative Gruenberg and I talked about that as well.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes. When we talked, Craig, a few days ago, we were talking about allowing the local municipal assembly to pass an ordinance that allowed this to be done or put regulations on it. And I hadn't done anything because I thought that you were going to be drafting something to be part of this bill, but I don't see it in here.
No, sir. Madam Chair, we discussed that and we talked about it, and that's a policy decision, and certainly if you would want to introduce that as an amendment, you know, but I that's a policy decision that I was not comfortable drafting into the legislation.
Yeah, I wish I had done that. I certainly want to before we take this bill up and pass it out. I was expecting to see it, frankly, in here. I was in the mode of just being able to look on it and approve it rather than I haven't drafted it.
We'll have you throw it out there today for discussion. One of the concerns, I have mixed views on it, and it would be great to hear the committee discussion on it, and you could pose it as conceptual. But the ability for a local assembly to simply say the state law doesn't apply is a big exception. It's huge. And so the question is, you know, how much of a statement do we want to make as a state legislature? If we believe that the law of the state ought to be that you can't take private property from one individual away and give it to another for mere economic development purposes, and in the case of recreational, take away someone's private residence for recreational purposes, if we believe in that, and that the Kelo decision ought to be overturned, if you will, in our state, or that it shouldn't apply to our state, then you probably don't want to have a huge gaping exception like that. Because if that's the policy we want to make, then we don't want to say that it's okay for Assembly X, Y, or Z to simply decide that they don't agree. I'm also a big local control person, and so I recognize that you know, there are thoughts out there about local governments being able to govern themselves, and there are places, as you know, we've made very bold statements in state law and simply said this is the law of the state, and places where we've said we're going to look to the local government. So it's definitely a policy call. There isn't a right or wrong answer there. And I would be, when we get to that point, as we continue through, I would appreciate your amendment.
Well, thank you. I frankly wasn't prepared to have the details of an amendment before you. I'm prepared to start the dialogue today, but I would like to really, before I put something before this committee, have input from folks from the AML, the municipalities we represent, and folks to really look at how that should be drafted, just by way of previewing the preview, because the question to me is who decides?
Yeah,
as many of these questions we address come down to the question in this case is who decides? Should we decide on a statewide basis for all the municipalities, or should home rule municipalities, and they all primarily do zoning? We don't do zoning around here. That's local. And the question is, do we want to start down the path of doing zoning in the state legislature? When, as I recall, in the Constitution, it gives lots of local authority to do that sort of thing. And we've got to have that in a state that's one-fifth the size of the United States. I don't want Congress or the state legislature determining on Kenai Avenue in Anchorage, where we have our little house, whether I can put a mudroom. I don't think that's our role, and I really think that's a question of who decides, and that's the way I would frame the issue.
Okay, further questions, Mr. Johnson? Okay, we've got some folks here to testify. Representative Guerra.
Yeah. Before you leave, there are two issues in this bill. One is the Supreme Court's opinion that I think most of us want to make sure it doesn't get applied in Alaska.
We
don't want to let one powerful private person convince the government to take away a weaker private person's property. And that's the bulk of this bill. I would say to Craig and to the sponsor to make sure we really prevent that from happening. These places where you have exceptions to the rule, where you will let the government take one person's property for another private economic development, I understand why those are in there, but I would say that we should make sure that we only allow that to happen when it's necessary for that project. Right? You can imagine a case where an oil company comes in and says, gets the government to say, let's take away somebody's property because there's valuable gas or oil underneath, but they could just as well access it from neighboring property and they wouldn't have to take away the person's property. So I would say on these exceptions that you have where you are going to allow private transfers from one unwilling property owner to a desirous property owner, I would say you should only allow those things where it's necessary for that project. We could work on language, but I think it would be pretty easy to insert.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrett, thank you. We had discussions about that with the AG's office, and one of the prerequisites for eminent for taking property is necessity. It needs to be necessary, and I think that's cited in 0955-270, and that's one of the enabling pieces. I don't think you'll have it there, but it is necessity is one of the things that you have to prove before you can take property.
I'll take a look at that. If that's in there, then it's okay.
Representative Coghill.
Just that had occurred to me as well, that before we pass this law out, we'd like to see what the vetting process is for an agency to claim eminent domain and how other municipalities might look at it, because we might actually be coming into an area where we've set policies that find themselves in contradiction to some of the local areas. I don't know what that range looks like. And we're forming exceptions, as Representative Guerra said, that I don't know how that actual impact is going to be to a system that's already in place. So that's been kind of a hard thing for me to get my head around, mainly because I haven't studied down to it. I haven't actually wandered through the process. Because we've already, by policy, said that local areas do have the right to exercise eminent domain. We're just kind of crafting these exceptions. Because we do have, I think, a legitimate state interest because of subsurface issues, access issues, and some of the huge issues like pipelines and stuff. I would like to know better the impact. Not that I need to know every code that's ever written, but at least how we expect them to interact with the state law.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly how much time you're going to take on researching that. I could follow it along the way.
Well, we've got Kevin Ritchie here, which will give you, his perspective, he'll tell you, is, for us not to do anything, to be blunt, or maybe a little less stronger, but, yeah, to leave it to the local authorities.
Kevin doesn't need to testify.
The policy question, though, is it appropriate for this state legislature to make a statement about how we feel about this state and any of the instrumentalities all the way down taking private property and transferring it to another private entity for economic development purposes? That's the point of Kelo. And so while I agree and there's this tenuous balance, that's the thing to keep your eye on the ball about, is whether or not you believe that is a fundamental important statement to make as a legislature or not. And if you don't, then don't. Then don't vote for it and don't support it. But if you do, then I think what you want to be careful about is gutting the bill so much that you can drive a truck through it. And then the only other thing that I would just make a point is that we'll bring it back up again on Friday, but prior to that, because I really do have some sense of wanting to get this moving along, and this committee, I dearly love it, has a habit of, we could spend a month on this bill. And so if members would try to turn their attention between now and Friday to the existing statute as well, which is Article 4, and this is I'll give you this site, but it's 955-240. And then it goes through right now, the way we do it, it spells out sort of the authorized uses that exist right now today. So just to be clear, what we're talking about in this bill, we already say that if it's federal land, if it's public buildings and grounds, if it's public buildings and state buildings and these things, we already say that that's where eminent domain can be used if necessary. And Mr. Johnson appropriately pointed out there's a test for it, a standard. But so that's already out there. I mean, we're not discussing that today. We're not trying to say that we want to take away the city of Kenai's right to exercise the power of eminent domain over its public lands or over public lands that may be held by the United States of America, by the federal government. But what we're saying is where we really want to be careful is in the place where it's a private person's property and you're transferring it to another private person, that's a place that we think is very sacred. And this Kelo decision sort of came out from nowhere and said, oh my goodness, we think a shopping mall is a great idea and great economic development, and we know that you oppose it, we know that you dearly want to keep your land, but we as a government, as a city government, are going to go against that, and we're going to take your land and give it to another private company to develop this for economic development, and we believe that's a high purpose. And so here we sit today saying, me, as the prime sponsor, I disagree. I fundamentally disagree with that. So that's me putting it out as a sponsor, and then it's for you, obviously, as the members, to decide whether you agree with me or not. But I certainly don't want to go so far as to say we want to tie the hands of local municipalities or even the state to say, on public lands, you can't do this. I mean, I would hope that you would do it carefully in the way that we have laid it out. But when it comes to private land, I am comfortable making a bold policy statement. Representative Coghill.
It's always nice when we could push the button of the chairman.
Yes.
My only concern was the impact that the exceptions have. I think both in 240 and 260, we very clearly said that the right of eminent domain happens under these circumstances. So I think the application is already very clear. I just hadn't had a chance to look down some of the things that we're putting in DE and F. To the degree that I felt that it was consistent with those. And I don't know the process beyond what we have in statute. So that would probably be the only place that I would have the question. So, but it's always nice to push your buttons. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. You get some of my
best
thoughts.
I agree with your conclusion. I just want to get there with you. That's all.
Yeah. And we'll have Kevin Ritchie come forward, and that'll be an opportunity for us to ask them questions about what some of the AML's concerns are and how it plays out. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting when people think of who's liberal, conservative, left, right, center, wherever. And we all come out on different things, and often, at least I find myself wondering, my goodness, it's really, you know, I think what I'm saying is right a lot of times, but puts me far to the right sometimes or far to the left in where I think I normally am. And this may be one of those times because, you know, I phrased it before as a question of who decides. That may be somewhat of a simplistic statement because, as you were pointing out, Madam Chair, at least you kind of did, I can see the state setting the policy if the state is seizing a piece of property. I don't want the locality or the federal government setting the standards for the state. And I can see us making a bold statement for state seizures. But when the municipality does it, I think that's in the municipality's jurisdiction. And if the voters don't like what the municipality does, their remedy is to get them not to do it, to amend the ordinance or vote new people in. We have a big state and we are far away from the population centers. And I would submit that even if we were smack in the middle of Anchorage, and this was an Anchorage seizure on my home block, people wouldn't come. They turn out for municipal assembly meetings, not for it. We're a very cumbersome thing. And for this, I think the municipality should decide municipal seizures, feds should decide federal seizures, and we should decide state seizures. I'm just sort of saying that it's not just who decides, but who decides for what kind of a seizure. It depends. I think we should look at who's doing the seizing. And secondly, the question of protecting people here is a really, we got to focus on page 4, lines 11 to 14, which allows the same seizure to occur, but only if the governor wants it and the legislature approves it. So it allows the same seizure to occur. It's just a question of who decides. And it's not just a question of the legislative body deciding it under this draft. It's that the governor's got to decide it. So even the legislature doesn't have the authority. And it may be politically that the governor would want to do something or would refuse to do something that the legislature would think is good public policy. So this whole thing, as long as we're previewing the issues that are raised, I'd like to focus on even what the legislature's role is. Do we want to be hamstrung and tied to the governor? In one sense, that makes it harder. But my goodness, that may make it too hard.
You know, and Representative Grunberg, great points. And part of me, the 7 was thrown in again at the end to try and find a way. And I'm not, as I said before, my gut instinct on it, the more that I think about it, is that it's unnecessary anyway. I mean, the reality is that at any point, at any time, the legislature has the ability to enact a bill that would completely overturn what we decide today in this legislature. And so to spell it out as a process that you go through, whether it's the governor submitting it to the legislature and the legislature approving, or whether it's the legislature submitting it to itself and approving, to me is really, I mean, I will likely make an amendment just to remove the section because I think it's unnecessary. The fact of the matter is that power exists anyway. And if we decide to do it, then we decide to do it. And I think it's distracting to spell it out as if it has to go through some formalized process, which I don't disagree, may or may not be appropriate. Maybe the governor doesn't have the right information about it. Maybe he or she, you know, doesn't have the expertise. Maybe it's a member of the legislature. So I kind of want to, I will just announce that I'm going to make an amendment to remove that, to remove distraction from it, because the more that I think about it, the more I just think it's unnecessary. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with you. And so that we can discuss this more easily as we go through the bill, just let me make clear to the people who don't have the bill in front of them, there are two parts of the bill. The one part is what we've been talking about most of the time here, which is we don't want government to say we can take one person's private property and give it to another person. That's the Kelo part. And I think most of us are in agreement about that part of it. It was a pretty outrageous Supreme Court decision, I thought, too. The other part that I think there's going to be some more debate about, and I think that the municipalities are concerned about, that I'm concerned about for even different reason, is the additional section that goes beyond the Kelo decision, which is Section E at page 4, line 15. And that's the one that says when the government does a taking, it can't, in certain circumstances, if it involves the taking for recreational use. And so I'd like to hear people, if people have views on the part that says you can't take from one private person to give to another private person, great. If you have comments on the part that says that addresses the recreational liability part, that's fine. but I'd like the people, I'd like people as they testify to sort of distinguish between the two issues. And I personally would like to have government to have the opportunity to possibly help gain maybe public access to a fishing stream, public access to a hunting trail, public access to a boating stream, or even allow. I'm somewhat supportive of trails, and I know that's a big dispute here. So that's the one that I'm going to focus my attention on.
Okay. Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, there are lots of people here to testify on just that, and I think they'll clearly identify it. Just in terms of clarification, the 1,000 linear feet of the home owner's property was put in there as sort of a holding point. I mean, that translates into 80 acres. That's huge. I'm not sure that's the number. Maybe something less than that. Maybe we're talking about protecting a 4-acre parcel, which would translate into about 250 feet in any direction. And that's using public education and the area of a circle to get to that rough number. But that's roughly what we're talking about. So 80 acres probably isn't the number. That's probably too big. 4 acres is more likely. I think if you have a home out in the wilderness that's blocking access that you're talking about to a boating trail, we should be able to find our way around 4 acres. So that's not necessary to take this person's home that they live in. Not a recreational cabin, not a hunting cabin, not a duck shack, but their home. That's where they live, that's where they raise their kids, and that's where their garden grows. So there's a huge difference in, you know, taking someone's, and you're going to have people testify today that will say you shouldn't take anyone, any property, whether I live on it, whether I own it, whether anything, for recreational purposes, period. So you're going to have that extreme on the issue. And then we've narrowed it down to a person's home because we truly believe, the sponsor believes, that that is the highest, greatest calling of land to be used. And as the chairman stated, with only 1% in private hands, taking a home is an egregious step. So if you can narrow down from 80 acres to a reasonable amount, and I have all, I can translate it from, you know, if it's 100 feet, it's 3/4 of an acre. If it's 300 feet, it's 6.5 acres. So those are more manageable sizes. Those give any department, anyone, the ability to go around. And also it kind of, that necessity, it's not necessary to take that. So it kind of plays into the definition of what you can and can't take anyway. So I think that might be a good first step if we were to address that and weren't that, so maybe it would put people's mind at ease. We're not talking about someone out there who's got 80 acres that we can't touch that they live on. So maybe if we address that and narrow that down a little bit, maybe that would allow you to have the trails that you're fond of without interfering with someone's private personal dwelling.
Just real quick, that would help you get maybe to the fishing stream, but you need to be able to walk along the fishing stream, and so the size really doesn't matter at that point, and that's really my biggest concern. You've got a river that you can't wade because it's too deep. You need to be able to fish along the bank. And
Madam Chair, Representative Graber, my understanding is that we have access to, the state owns those lands where the rivers. So that's a problem.
The problem is there's a lot of private land that's going to get developed on some of the most popular streams in the state, and I don't want to lose it.
If someone is living on that property, that's a different story than someone having a recreational cabin. So if it's a recreational cabin, that is not covered under this. That's if they don't meet the criteria that we've set out as a home. So if someone is living along that recreational, if that whole river is taken up with someone's home, some people's homes of less than 4 acres or whatever the number we decide, I would contend that those people own that property and it's probably not appropriate for us to take that from them.
And that's
a policy decision.
Yep.
That's not mine.
And Representative Guerra and I talked about it this morning, and that is, to be clear, I'm setting slightly different thresholds in the sense that in the first half of the bill, so there's two parts, that, as Representative Guerra said, the first half I'm being very clear that in the area of economic development, any private to any private is what we're trying to avoid. In the area of recreational uses, we're setting a different standard, and we're saying that if it's your private residence, and then it's the question of if we adopt my amendment, 4 acres or 80 acres or whatever that is, in your private residence, that's the place where I'm choosing to draw the line, to say that, again, private to private. Now, perfectly willing, if necessary and so on, under existing state law, to take state land, municipal land, federal land, all those things, but it's people's private land, and it's not just any private land. So it's not the private land that, say, a Native corporation owns as an investment because they want to. It's the private land on which your residence sits. And that's the issue to me, is that, as I said before, and it's just one of these policy things, that for me, that is the sacred space for a family. And I don't feel that it's appropriate to look at a bill like this and simply say economic development is an inappropriate use to take away your private property, but recreational use is for your home. And so that's where the policy debate will be on that. But let's go to the folks that are here patiently listening to us blabber. I'll just go in order of what I have here, unless somebody wants to slip me a note that they have a time constraint, but we'll wrap up here at 3 in our regularly scheduled time. So Ruth Blackwell with the Alaska Association of Realtors.
I'm Ruth Blackwell. I'm with the Alaska Association of Realtors. I'm a realtor in Juneau here with Powell Realty. And it's been an interesting discussion so far. I kind of want to fill you in on the Alaska Association and the National Association. Since the Kilo decision, we've been diligently working, trying with all the states to, our thrust is private property rights. That's what our thrust is. And the National Association and the Alaska Association have come out with 3 general policy decisions. First, the use of eminent domain only when necessary to materially advance the real or substantial public use, i.e. road, airport, power lines, public buildings, that is definitely for people.
Ms. Blackwell, would you, just prior to reading that, would you be willing to leave a copy of that with the committee?
I can give you one that I haven't scratched on. I can email one.
That would be fantastic. Thank you.
The government should provide persuasive, objective evidence that the project and the resulting use will, in fact, be reached. It's an obtainable goal. And just compensation should include not only the value of the condemned property, but also the other reasonable and necessary costs generated by the condemnation. We're not discussing that here today, but that's part of the 3 parts. We are in favor of this bill, especially the first half that we were talking about, 2 halves. The first half, particularly, we do not believe that we should have private property go be done by eminent domain down to another private. We think that that's and we think we're happy with the definitions. We were a little concerned. We want to make sure that there is no room for debate on what the legislature intended economic development and economic project to mean, and the term public use, and that's been taken care of in this bill. The point of the residents only being exempt, we have a little difficulty in that. Many of the recreational parcels in Alaska start out as recreational parcels, and by the time you clear it and build it and put it together, you have a home, and you move out of the city and you go in that home, and you've probably put that cabin together with the kids and the aunts and the uncles and the friends, and it has a real soul. So if that piece can be taken for recreation or for some other thing that's not definite public use, then it's a real emotional thing to private property owners in the state of Alaska. If you go out the road, 40 years ago, all those were cabins, And it took us an hour to get there from downtown. And now they're homes. So we would hate to see that the people that put their heart and soul into their properties, whether it be a cabin they built or where they tent up with their family or whatever, we would hate that we're not in favor of someone being able to come in and say, well, it's really nice that you spent 20 years building that cabin, but you really do live downtown, so now we want to take your cabin away, and all of us want to walk through your property. And so in that regard, we would like to have it not be just for the residential. The third item we talked a little bit about that is not in the bill is the Alaska housing issue. Presently, Alaska Housing has the ability under the Slum Clearance Redevelopment Act to come in and through eminent domain take properties. We don't have a problem with the theory of it. We would just prefer that it was more done by elected authorities rather than an administration. We would rather have people that are elected in the hot seat for if they decide something is a slum and everybody doesn't think so. So that it's not the theory. We would just prefer it not to be an administrative measure. But aside from that, if anyone has any questions.
Thank you. And Representative Lynn has a bill that addresses the Alaska Housing Finance.
Right, and we're working.
Yeah. Yeah. My bill, or this bill does not. So just to be clear on that. Okay, thank you. Questions for Ms. Blackwell? Representative Guerra?
I might just ask you to think about this as you testify on these bills. Just think about this policy issue. I grew up in the lower 48 where probably at least 46, if not 49 of the other states have done it the wrong way. You can't walk up and down what used to be the best rivers in those states to fish with your kids. You can't walk up and down those rivers to camp because they're all owned by people who have homes on them. Probably not the greatest policy call in those states. In this state, we can walk up and down those rivers and fish. Today, the question is, we'll be able to do it 20 years from now when the population has expanded and people have now move their homes onto those rivers. And so what I would ask you to think about is, do we want a state where right now Montana Creek is and Willow Creek and Little Willow Creek and the Anchor River and Deep Creek, these are roadside streams in south central Alaska where people fish for salmon and trout and steelhead. They're the lifeblood of a lot of people, including myself. I must declare. So in the interest of full disclosure, I want to know that 20 years from now, if we want to get public access to those streams, they're privately owned right now, but they haven't been built on, so you can walk up and down, nobody cares. The private property owners don't care. I'm worried that 20 years from now, if too much of those streams have become privately developed, all of a sudden everybody gets their little piece, and then the rest of us have nothing, and we've lost those streams. So I just ask you to think about how we can deal with that and prevent that from happening.
Yeah, we'll discuss. Representative Parkin.
I wanted to encourage her on the thought that she had about the cabins in recreational area, and I'm going to take that very seriously because I agree that many times that's how communities have grown, and in probably contrast to the representative to my right here, I think in Alaska we have more wild and scenic rivers than any place in the world where people have access to, and 220 million acres of Alaska has been set aside for people to have access to. So, and less than 1% of the whole shoot match in Alaska is allowed to be private at this point. So, I think I would probably go to the side that if a person was able to get a piece of property that they had on a river, I would want to leave them alone. The only thing that I would probably shoot for was to make sure that people did have a very various access points to that river because it's a place that we obviously in Alaska have held in high esteem and in common use. So, and I'll agree with them on that point. But because of the limitation of private property and the vast stretches of public land that we have in Alaska, I don't think that's going to be a problem. So, but I think in looking at the recreational home sites, if it's not the primary residence, you've brought up a good point, and I just want to thank you for that.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. This goes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago, a question of who decides. In the vast areas of the state, I don't have a problem with what Representative Coghill says, but in Anchorage, we've got the user population and we have the landowner population. And I'm going to focus on something like the Coastal Trail. The user population comes from all over, and many of them people who are not right there in the area and couldn't afford to be. But they walk the trail, they walk their dogs on the trail, they bike the trail, they rollerblade the trail, and that sort of a thing. And the question is quite different than the vast areas of the state, only 1% of the area is occupied. We're talking largely about what goes on inside that 1%. And that's why I think that probably the people who live in that 1%, who have the interest in that 1%, should make the decision in that 1% rather than just the person who happens to live on the land. We represent all the people, not just the person who happens to live there. And with due respect, I think that we need to look at this not in the Benthamite sense of the greatest good for the greatest number, but in the sense of who should decide that issue in that area. And it's the way you frame the issue that may be outcome determinative here.
I want curtains to close after he speaks. Act two.
So far, no one's asked you a single question. Just while we know.
Oghill's crying. You're mesmerized. Gavel to gavel.
She's never going to come back to this committee. Everyone's just speaking.
I'm going back to the valley.
I appreciate it.
On my piece of property next to the creek.
Now, Ruth, now you see what my job's like. It's the full gamut. Thank you so much for listening. You're really all you did today. Okay. I'm going to go to, let's see, Pete Putzier. That's right.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Putzier. I'm with the Alaska Department of Law, and I represent Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I won't go through the entire bill. There's just one area that I did want to cover, and I was listening closely, of course, to the testimony, and there was some discussion about the paragraph D7 that's at the at page 4 of the CS. And I think that, as currently drafted, that language is not going to work. I agreed with many of the comments that were expressed here. But I would like to propose something, at least for consideration. The subparagraph D that we're looking at is found in the section of the bill specifically directed towards transfers of property from a private person to a private entity. That's what section D is going to. It's that portion of the bill that we've discussed, that has been discussed here today. Unless there is something like a subsection 7 that allows for an out, then we would be prohibiting, under any circumstances, a transfer from one private individual to a private entity. And I'm not sure that we want to go quite that broad. We might want to have an instance that we can't think about right now that, for whatever reason, we want to take property and give it to a private entity. An example that was given to me by someone else at Department of Law was, imagine there's an earthquake and for whatever reason that former owner didn't develop the property, didn't do anything with it. We might want to take the property and give it to a private entity to develop, for instance. There are probably going to be other examples that we can't foresee right now. And so rather than have something very broadly worded in 7 that just is generalized out for something the legislature hasn't thought of before, I would propose that at least we consider something more narrowly drafted in number 7 that would allow for a private-to-private transfer based on the facts of a particular case. And that's the only comment that I have right now. I did agree with the general sentiments that were expressed here that subparagraph D7, as it's currently drafted, would not be acceptable. I agree with that. I just submit to you that perhaps there still is a purpose for that section. That's my only comment. Thank you.
Representative Garrett?
Madam Chair, I think you might come up with a provision, but what you just said is exactly the reason why I don't want the government to be able to take somebody's land. You pointed to the example of somebody whose life is in a shambles because of an earthquake, and there's somebody eager to develop it. The person whose life is a shambles, and we give it to Walmart. And, I'm just not going to do that. It's the very reason for the bill.
Well, you might not like the through the chair, Representative Guerra. I agree the example might not be one that you would like, but I'm sure we could think of other examples that would be less objectionable where we do want to do a private-to-private transfer. Some large companies might be able to better do some kind of a large-scale operation that the government can't do, that a private person
You're
can't do.
Another example that doesn't sound like what I'm trying to prevent, too. I don't... Please come up with examples and let us know a legitimate place where we should take one person's property and give it to another person, but those two examples don't work for me.
Representative Gruenberg.
Two things. First of all, I'd like to see you draft up some language and pass it out, if you could, at some point. Would you do that, please?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, you mean specific to the subsection 7? I will do that, and I will come back with hopefully 2 to 3 persuasive examples.
And secondly,
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. You know, you, as Dan Ogg used to say on this committee, the devil's in the details. And on page 3, line 24, they used the term private person or, and that presumably would be private entity you're talking about there. And we might want to add private entity if we have this in here.
Right.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. But that implies that private person and private entity are different terms, or we would have used them the same term. Yet I don't see private entity defined in the bill. And I'm kind of looking at Mr. Johnson, the chair, you, and anybody else who's awake and around. That we ought to define private entity if indeed it's different than private person.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, this is not the final version of the bill, and there are several places in here. I'm sparing the committee currently going through all those, but where I think there do need to be changes made. What you identified is one of those specific areas. The way person is defined in our statute, ASO 160, is very broad, and it's not clear exactly what is meant by adding the phrase or entity. And so you've hit on something that is important that we're going to have to address.
If you could provide, through the chair, if you could provide a written outline of your testimony or even written testimony, including today what you said, because I'm looking at Susan, who's not looking at me over there, but stop. I was going to ask to have a transcript of some of the stuff you said. If you could maybe take the unusual steps of giving us written testimony and attaching your proposed amendments, that would be extremely helpful.
Representative
Garrett. Thanks. Representative Gruenberg, if that was the first time I heard this since I've been in the legislature this session, I wouldn't cause me a warning bell, but I've now heard many representatives asking for people to give them written testimony, and I think we should be careful about that. It's a burden. I think that there might be
something. This is an attorney. He is by nature careful.
I would hope we wouldn't ask him to write up his testimony.
Well, I just want to be certain that what you said does not get lost in the reliquary of time.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, do I understand that what you're requesting is for me to reduce to writing the general points that I made today?
Yes.
Or a verbatim transcript?
No.
Okay.
Anything you wish.
If you want it to be a part of this bill, I would recommend you getting it to us by Friday. Or you could make it a part of this bill in finance, or...
I can do that by Friday.
I mean, it should be in this committee. We're the, unless it's a fiscal issue.
Be great. Okay, thank you. Next, I have Lisa Kirsch. Okay. Kevin Ritchie.
Ma'am.
Representative Gruenberg.
May I ask, Ms. Kirsch, who do you represent? Was there anything you wanted to add to what he said? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Ritchie.
Madam Chair, thank you. Kevin Ritchie, and I do have good things to say that will help you.
Oh, good.
Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League. This is clearly a legitimate issue for the state to take up, and if you, obviously we would support the state taking a stand on the issue, but one that really worked for communities as well as it works for the state and so on. We appreciate the narrowing of the bill to the questions that were actually raised by the Kelo decision, you know, in terms of economic development, instead of a broad prohibition of eminent domain for economic development. You know, the fact is that in Alaska, as you all know, jobs are real important, and we probably don't do enough economic development. There's probably very bad ways, and there's probably very good ways, and I won't try to come up with an example, but in the case of the way Section 7 is presently written, yes, it does provide a very, very, very long shot that a municipality would be able to do something that 99% of the municipality thought was a good idea. Because, say, in the case of Nome, if there's a wonderful project in Nome that 3,499 of the 3,500 people or so on support, it would take an action of the legislature. And Nome only has access to one senator and one representative. So, you know, that probably isn't a reasonable help for that situation that's really valuable to Nome. What I would recommend, and again, I wish I were more timely with this. We have our own sort of legislative process, and we had our legislative committee, part of it in town today, and we worked on this, so I have the ability to offer some suggestions. But we would like to work with staff if you think there's that this would be a solution to that problem. Is basically the statute now is silent on one thing that was a factor in the Kelo case, which is delegating your eminent domain authority to a private nonprofit corporation. We feel, in fact, history bears this out, but we feel that that should remain with the Assembly or the City Council. So a simple statement on eminent domain number one, that eminent domain may not be transferred or delegated. That would cut off probably 100% of the Kelo cases, you know, in terms of eminent domain. And the second one is specifying that, you know, if the legislature has to pass a law to override this rule, that an assembly or city council would also have to pass a law. You know, we call it an ordinance, but that requires two public hearings. And it's very much like actually a city council might be exactly the number of people sitting here in front of me, and this might be actually 10% of the people in town, except the chambers would be packed, and they wait for you outside. And so
they know where you live.
Yeah, they know where you live, and they meet you in the grocery section. And so the reality is that municipalities historically have been very, very, very protective of property rights because they know the impact on the community, and they know the consequences of making bad choices. And so with those types of language changes, we'd be really happy to help with those. That would kind of take us out of Section 7 and probably tighten up this not only for economic development eminent domain, but just more clearly stating the process on all eminent domain takings.
Senator Gruenberg.
Thank you. Again, I'm going to say the same mantra I said to Mr. Putzier a minute ago. Could you please get us something in writing?
Yes.
I'm happy to work with you on that and provide anything we can for our legal counsel.
Through the chair, yes, we'd be happy to do that.
The other thing I'd like to do, and I'm specifically looking at you and your team of municipal lawyers. This is important. I'd like you to look at Article 2, Section 19 of the state constitution that prohibits local or special acts, which would make it particularly difficult for this legislature to deal with a situation only in Nome, because we can't generally do a local act. And then also the stuff that's in the local government article of the Constitution, which I think is number 10, dealing with the constitutional protections that municipalities enjoy. What it says, purpose of this article is to provide for maximum local self-government, and that they enjoy real constitutional protections. And if we go very far in this area, I think we're going to run afoul of Article 10. And I would like your people to look at that and maybe get a legal opinion on both those issues as to the legislature's constitutional limitation in this area that's traditionally local.
Okay, so you've got a champion over here.
Yes, you do.
To introduce your amendments, and that would be great if you could get them synthesized down by Friday. Okay, further questions of Mr. Ritchie, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. Just if you could let me know, or if any other the committee members want it to, we found from the municipality of Anchorage that when they were putting together the coastal trail, one of the things that enabled them to do it originally was the power to use eminent domain. We've got an article from 1993 that talks about that and enabled them to put together the coastal trail in the first place. Do you have if you could let me know if there are any other examples you know of where cities responsibly used eminent domain or something like that, maybe a boat dock or something like that, just so we can see where they're using it, where they're not, whether it's prevalent or not. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. Okay, Chip.
Oh. Well, Madam Chair, I was going to say that we did query a number of communities and said, have you had problems with eminent domain? Have, you know, it's been controversial situations, and we haven't found any in relation to economic development. Juneau, for example, part of the green belt was big pieces of land that were were acquired by eminent domain, I think. And I'll get you that information to the best we can. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, Chip Wagner. I want to make sure it was noted a long time ago Representative Cott was joined us, and we'll wrap up here. This is actually the last person I have on my list to testify today, and so we'll roll Human Rights Commission over to Friday and end with Mr. Wagner.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Chip Wagner. I'm wearing a different hat this afternoon. I'm newly elected president of the Southeast Alaska Board of Realtors, and I'm here at the request of the chairman of the Alaska Board of Realtors Legislative Committee and representing my own local regional board. First, I'd like to reiterate and support everything that Ruth Blackwell said on behalf of our larger state organization. Before this committee, I think, are various issues. First of all, we appreciate, Madam Chairman, the bill being introduced, taking care of the Kelo decision. We think that's very, very important. The issue, then, is what more, if anything, do you want the committee to do? This is not an area of law that the legislature deals with very often. There are some sections of the eminent domain statutes that have not been touched since the 60s. So if you're going to do something, I guess the issue is, do you want to just do something in a limited fashion, or do you want to take a broader view of looking at some of these issues? Now, the realtors, as Ruth Blackwell has said, is very, very concerned about protecting private property rights, particularly personal homes and recreational properties. And I also wearing, in addition to my Southeast Board of Realtors hat, I'm wearing my hat as a private property owner. I'm fortunate to own remote piece of property in southeast Alaska, an island. And I would hate to see the government want to take a portion of that, which would destroy the value of it, particularly since out of the 29 islands in the borough of Juneau, 21 of them are completely owned by government. Four of them, Douglas Island, Shelter Island, Admiralty Island, and Spoon Island, large portions of those are owned by the government. That leaves only four privately owned islands in the entire borough, all the way up to Haines. People that own remote properties, particularly when they have a cabin on them, feel more emotional about those properties than they do about their own personal residences. I know I do. So I think the bill right now is kind of saying you can absolutely not have eminent domain for these things, and you absolutely can for those things. But there's another way of looking at it. And the other way of looking at it is to have higher standards when the government wants to use eminent domain for different purposes. And that would be Section 270 of the statute. It's not in this bill. But Title 9, Chapter 55, Section 270 deals with standards that the government must use when they want to go after property. One of them is necessity. Now, the problem with it as it currently stands in the law is that the word necessity is undefined, so the courts define it. And it's not. And I think as time goes on, the courts will tend to be more and more liberal in this area. So instead of being defined as absolute necessity for the public use, it will be defined as requisite necessity. And indeed, that is exactly what's happened. So that's one option. If you wanted to deal with it, is to look at 270, and if you're going after certain kinds of property for less of a public use than, say, a school or a needed sewer line or something of that nature, you'd have the government would have a higher standard. So if they wanted to go after the stream bed, for example, or if they wanted to take my remote property, even though they have 21 other islands out there, they wanted mine too, they'd have to have a higher standard in order to reach it. And I think that would be a way to go if you wanted to do that, and that would be Section 270. One, for example, access to the river, just to use an example, if there were other options that they didn't have to use the private property, but if they went, 1,000 yards down the stream, there was another area there where it was government property, they could use that. And I think the realtors are very concerned about private property because there's so little of it in Alaska. I mean, if it was in other states, like the state I grew up in Connecticut, it would be a much bigger deal. But in Alaska, we have so little private property, it's important to keep what we have, particularly since, and then I'll close with this statement, the government, when we were a territory in the 50s, actually took by court action a lot of the private properties in southeast Alaska, because back in the teens, 20s, and 30s, a lot of property, private property, old homesteads, salteries, canning facilities, and whatnot, were abandoned. When people were done with them, they just walked off, mining facilities. And the government, by court action, took those properties, including the island I now own. And it was only by a stroke of luck that you could redeem those properties back in the 60s. Private enterprise can't redeem those properties anymore. I had a dock on this island. I can't get that dock back anymore, because the government in 1964 eliminated the right of private entities to go back and take those tideland rights back. So thank you very much.
Questions, Representative Groomberg?
I'm going to ask you to do the same thing I've asked these other people. Please get us some language. I like what you've said, Mr. Wagner.
I'll try.
Quantitative kinds.
If we can get a transcript of this hearing, that would be a big help. Thank you.
Okay. Any amendments that people have to the bill? Craig Johnson of my office is coordinating and has been working to try to bring the very broad spectrum of views that you've heard today together into something. And so he's the person to talk to. But it would be helpful if you can synthesize it down into something that you'd like into the bill, and then we can vote it up or down. in the committee, and I'll leave public testimony open so that folks can comment as the bill morphs. And if there are folks who couldn't make it here today, then they'll have an opportunity to testify again. So with that, House Judiciary is adjourned for today.